Welcome to Making Movies Is Hard, a podcast about the everyday struggles of being an independent filmmaker. I'm Mark Bissell.
I'm Liz Manischel.
This week, we spoke to filmmakers who made these films, these wonderful wonderful indie films, The Mix and Family Obligations, Chris Malika and Ken Frank. Did I say it right that time?
I just want to call him Malika, but I believe it is Malika. And I've just been like
sweet.
Fooling myself for years.
I didn't fail.
You did great.
So this was a really fun conversation. Going into this, I had no really background for Ken or Chris. Like, I looked up a little bit. I watched the trailer for Family Obligations, that was kind of it. And I had no idea the level of budget that they were working with for these films. And wow, it is low. And I was like going through a crisis with my budget at the time, I was going through a crisis with my budget at the time, which has since been resolved and taken care of through like two miracles, basically, which do happen, apparently.
That's fantastic. I'm so glad that happened.
Yeah. It's like, you know, it was such a frustrating thing because I'll just be open. I mean, I'm not going to talk. I can't talk full budget because that's a no-no for distributors. But basically, I had like, let's say, 80% of my budget and of my production budget. And then I was like looking for like the last 20% and like maybe 75%, 80, whatever, around there. And it was a large amount of money. And it's like, you know, in my mind, I felt like, oh, if I only had 75%, I could figure it out. But I basically had crunched the numbers with my producer over and over again. And there's like no way I could do it. And so I needed this last like 20, 25%. And then hearing the budgets that these guys work with, I just felt like such a turd. It's like, you know, such a small fraction, you know, or a fraction, I should say, of my budget. And it's like, oh man, like, you know, why am I complaining? You know, but I think it's just when you work at a different level, it just things change pretty quickly as far as like what is high budget and what's a low budget.
Everything's relative. They were shooting and they shoot in the East Coast, right? I think it's
right.
I get Long Island and New Jersey mixed up. So I know it was one of those places.
I think it was Long Island.
Okay. I'm the worst. Yeah. I recognize it from California and I don't know geography. Right. But yeah, so I think everything's relative and I wouldn't think that they feel like they're looking at you with your big money problems and that you're ridiculous. I mean, I think everyone, you know, and like by comparison, there are $1 million movies having the same problems that we would kind of look to and say, well, that you got to solve that problem. But I'm not resentful towards you for that.
Right. Problem. No. I mean, yeah. And I appreciate that. But it's just like because we had recorded an episode with Brett and Drew, or I had recorded an episode with Brett and Drew, Pierce, who, you know, finishing their film, The Wretched, or are in, you know, festival run with their film right now. And I asked them that question. They had a good answer for me because it was like I was at the same time, basically. And then I asked Chris and Ken and I just felt like I already knew the answer to the question before I asked it. But I think they still said some interesting stuff, which was great.
Well, I got into like a little bit of a Twitter conversation with Ken that I wanted to bring up. Which is I went to a mentor session for women in film. I like got accepted by my first filmmaker support organization ever after two features. And I went to this mentor session and they were like, what do you want to do? And I was like, I want to stay in micro budget and I want to make one movie every 5 years. And I want to do another jobby job while I make those movies. And they're like, well, that sounds like a hobby. And I'm like, well, it kind of is. And they're like, well, do you want to leave micro budget? And I said, no. And they said, you're scared.
I was
like really insulted by that because that's like no one wants to be called scared. And they said, you're placing limitations on yourself because you're afraid of trying for something bigger. And I mentioned this on Twitter and Ken and I had like this very long Twitter conversation where he rightfully so believes that people shouldn't abandon the micro budget film because that there's a fabulous community there. And we shouldn't always defer to the advice of people who work in larger budgets because there's a place for every artist. But it was just such an interesting idea is that I'm like battling, you know, my own mind and like, am I restricting myself? Am I scared? And then I have Ken, like the angel on my other shoulder saying, no, stay in micro budget. Like we need to build a community here. So I'm still a little split, but I wanted to say that the passion that Ken has for micro budget, the passion Ken has for micro budget is really admirable. And I love, you know, how he wants to really make a difference with these smaller films.
Yeah, that's great. So I have many questions based off that, because that's very fascinating to me. And this is something that I've talked about on the podcast and off the podcast. But like, you know, the tendency for people is like, we'll make your first low budget, micro budget feature, and then your next movie has to be like, whatever, X amount bigger budget. And then, or you're failing, basically, is like the kind of idea. And I've always kind of fought against that. Like, I kind of feel like, you know, I just want to make another movie. So it's not necessarily that the next one has to be a bigger budget. Like, I would even go lower budget, you know, and go to more micro budget movie for the next one, just if it fits the movie, because, you know, every movie's different and certain movies can be made at certain budget levels and certain movies can't be made at certain budget levels. And I feel like, you know, for the alternate, like, I'm going as low as I possibly can to make this movie. But like, there's other movies ideas I have that you could do for a lot less. So I'm just curious to hear from you, like, why, I mean, just to prod deeper, like, why do you say you want to work only in micro budget? Is it just because you like that size and it's manageable and you feel like there's like return to be made on that level? Or is it just because you don't think you could raise more money? Or like, I'm just curious, like, why do you say that?
Honestly, this confrontation with this woman at Women in Film and the conversation with Ken, the conversation with you has been incredibly eye-opening, because I never actually examined why I wanted to say micro-budget. And I think it is fear. And that's what's so crazy. Oh,
really?
Yeah.
She was right. Oh, that's hilarious.
I think she was totally right. I sat in that meeting. I was incredibly miffed and angry. And then I thought to myself, give her a chance. Think about it. Why do you want to stay in micro-budget? And I was like, well, I don't want to keep on paying these amazing people very, very low wages. I keep on saying on this podcast over and over again, I want a place at the table. What does that mean? That means transitioning to larger projects. That means right. Working with publicists and agencies and, you know, bigger projects. And I think I've always been rejecting them before they've rejected me. And that's why I keep on saying I want to be in micro budget.
Interesting. Yeah, I, you know, I think about this a lot. It's like, for me, it's more like, I want to be hireable and I want to make this a career. What I don't want to do is I don't want to spend another 5-6 years waiting to make the next movie. Like, I want to be making the next movie, as soon as this movie is done, or even like starting on it while this movie is being wrapped up. You know, I was listening to one of the Just Shoot It episodes, and they were talking to Natalie Metzger, I think is her name, this producer of Greener Grass.
Actually. I love Natalie. She's so wonderful.
And she was talking about Jim Cummings and how, like, they've got a feature that's in post right now, and they're about to jump into production on their next feature, you know, together. And it's like, that's what I want. I want one feature to be in post-production and just wrapping up, and I want to be able to go into production on the next feature, like, right away. Like, you know, I've read, like, an Oliver Stone, you know, biography, like, many years ago, and that was sort of, like, what his life sounded like. Like, he would just go, like, you know, production, and then while he's in post-production, he's in pre-production on the next one, then production, post-production, pre-production, you know, just, like, back and forth. And it's, like, that sounds really, like, exciting to me. And so what I don't want to happen is to, like, finish the alternate and then spend 5 to 10 years trying to raise, you know, twice the budget for my next movie, and then finally make my next movie. Like, I'd rather just make my next movie. And if it's a micro budget movie at even a lower budget, like, that's totally fine with me, but I just want to make movies. You know?
Well, yeah, I think the general answer, that is the appropriate answer, is that you make movies at whatever level you want to make them, but don't stop yourself from trying something just because it's scary. And to constantly question yourself why you're making the decisions you are. I want to keep on making micro-budget content. I told Ken that I have a micro-budget film in my back pocket that I want to make next year. And I'm about to shoot a micro-budget.
Right. You're making your third movie.
In January. So, right. Like, I definitely am fine here and I love it. But the idea is that I've never tried anything else. And why is that? And I think there's also an element of the women in film thing happening here, where the woman, and I don't mean the organization, I mean women in making movies, where I think that as a woman, that mentor wanted to make sure I wasn't restricting myself as a woman. And it wasn't necessarily as a filmmaker, but it was as a, like, if there are opportunities and you could take advantage of those, you should be going after those opportunities instead of stopping yourself.
Right. Well, I mean, that was going to be my next question is, like, if someone offered you, let's say, $2 million to make a movie, like, would you say no to that?
No, I absolutely would not say no, but
then there's nothing wrong. Right?
Yes, but I've never gone out to try for representation. I've never really tried to get big money. Like, I've never gone to large organizations for sponsorships and partnerships. Like, there's a lot of things that I've never tried. And I think a lot of times we just don't go after these things because they take time. But then, like, let's have three projects on our slate at once, and let's have one be a big project, one be the one you're going to make, you know, and one be the one in the back pocket. And I think that's the way to go forward, is to have the big project waiting so that you're not shooting yourself in the foot in terms of scope as an artist.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I feel like if you're open to doing a bigger project, then that's great, because, like, you know, like, I don't think... Like, if you said to yourself, like, I want to raise $1 million to make my next movie, it's like, I don't think it's going to be easier to raise $1 million because of that. I think, like, if $1 million project is going to happen for you, it's going to be outside forces that are going to come and bring that thing together. It's not going to be you saying, I'm going to raise $1 million, because, you know, raising $100,000 or $200,000 or $500,000 or $1 million, it's all extremely difficult, you know? And the more money you add to that, the more difficult it is, unless you have that ace in the hole, which I think it's going to come from something that happens from one of your movies. Like, someone's going to see Speed of Life and be like, oh my gosh, like, this woman is the one to direct our movie, and we have a $2 million budget.
You know? Right. Well, I think the question is, like, are you asking yourself, is the decision to make the $2 million film, right? Like, I think when we talked to Naomi McDougall-Jones, which is an episode that still hasn't come out, but will come out probably in a little bit, I mentioned how I never really wanted to make a studio picture. And I don't think that's lack of desire. I think that's fear. And that's what I think is crazy, is that I never acknowledged that.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I feel like I don't feel like I'm in a position to make a studio feature, but if someone was like,
dream big, Ulrich, dream big.
If someone wanted to hire me to do one, fuck yeah, man. I would go for it. Sure. I mean, if the alternate, like, has some crazy indie success and I'm getting offers to direct Marvel movies or what have you, I mean, geez, of course, I'm not going to shy down from that experience. Like, how few people get that opportunity, right? You know, but I don't think you would either, right?
But I was telling people that I was. I was telling people, like, I don't want a part of that. I want to make my movies. Right. I want my control.
Right.
And I think that
you were
was
rejecting it.
Yeah, okay. It was like the, you know, don't want to be a part of a club that would accept people like me as members. It was like Groucho Marx. And right. And I don't think Ken's like that. I really do think Ken has built a family. I mean, literally built a family around making movies. And right. I, you know, talk about idealistic episodes that we've been recording lately. Like, they've got it figured out. I want that life. I think the life of, like, working with your best friend as the lead actor and your partner is helping finance and produce and you're staying at home and shooting, like, that is fantastic. I love that.
Yeah, totally. Especially... And then if you're making the movies that you want to make and telling the stories you want to tell, then it's like you have the perfect combination of all the good things, basically.
iTunes.
So, yes. Should we do some iTunes? I think is it my turn now? Or
go
is
for it.
Your turn?
Yeah, it's your turn.
Oh, okay. All right. This review is titled, She Just Keeps Getting Better by Marcella Bella. And this is a little biased because Marcella is one of my producers on The Alternate and a longtime friend and longtime listener of the show. She also executive produced Timothy and I's movie, The Over My Dead Body, from a million trillion years ago. But I'm going to read it anyways. I love the Ulrich and Timothy podcast, but Ulrich has bumped it up a few notches with his mix of guest host casters. These episodes bring a whole new energy to the podcast, providing an entertaining variety of color, depth, and experience, Also listening to the expertise of the podcast guests who knew how much goes into this stuff. The animation, the cartoon show, the launching of a streaming platform. Incredible how hard people work on these projects. Truly inspiring. Marcella, 5 stars.
What a lovely human.
Yeah, Marcella is the best. I've been working with her a lot lately on the movie. We spent all day location scouting yesterday. But yeah, she's awesome. And, you know, it's really sweet. She does listen to every episode. She's like one of our bigger fans, which is really, really fun.
Well, shout out to Marcella.
Yeah, thanks, Marcella.
I'll take this next one. Fun new format, same great show, 5 stars by Frenetic. Hopefully the person's name is Fran, because that's a nice little pun. All right, love this podcast and hope the recently increased diversity of hosts. Oh, okay, I'm going to read that again. Love this podcast and love the recently increased diversity of hosts and guests. So often filmmaking podcasts are just 2 white straight bros chatting about making movies, though I enjoy and listen to a ton of those too. I miss Timothy, but the new format means we need to... Sorry, I just was going to say RIP, and then I thought that was inappropriate. I miss Timothy, but the new format means we get to hear a variety of filmmakers with diverse backgrounds, both interviewed and interviewing, alongside our intrepid host, Ulrich, remains one of my favorite filmmaking podcasts to have on rotation. Well, Frenetic, you are a lovely, lovely human.
Wow. Thanks, Frenetic. That's really sweet. And I really appreciate that they appreciate what I did with all the different hosts and, you know, recycling people through, because that was really fun. And we still will have guest co-hosts, even though we now have two full-time hosts. But Liz is welcome to bring in other people here and there. And, you know, we'll probably still have other ones with other people too. But yeah, I don't know. Luckily, I'm really grateful to have you as a co-host, Liz.
Oh, I'm grateful too, even though I just feel bad when I have a horrible schedule, but I am grateful.
Well, we both have horrible schedules. Both going into features. Oh my gosh, craziness. But that's what makes me so excited. It's like having two hosts who are actively making movies. It's like, that is what the show, what I wanted the show to be from the beginning, is like filmmakers talking about film, you know, and actually doing it and talking about the struggles that they're facing. That was the whole point, you know. So we're making it happen. All right. Last words about Chris and Ken before we get into the conversation.
I just really like them.
It is a really fun conversation, and it is really inspiring, and it is really the kind of thing. It's like, yeah, there's no barrier. Just do it, you know. Just get out of your own way and make your film. So hopefully other people find this inspiring too. So we're here with Chris Malika and Ken Frank. Frank. Can't believe I just did that. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
So before we get into all the goodness of filmmaking and working together and all that stuff, can you guys just give us your quick 1-minute bios on your background of who you are?
So I'm Ken Frank, and I'm a writer, filmmaker, and educator. I'm born, raised, and still based on Long Island, where I went to high school with Chris, and that's our connection initially. We're going to be talking about my first feature direction, Family Obligations.
And I am an actor, writer, and editor based out of Los Angeles. Been here now 14 years. And just kind of doing that grind out here. You've seen me in, I've sold you things such as eBay, and you've seen me on shows such as Westworld in a very small hat. So.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
What role did you play in Westworld?
He's the origin of Westworld. He started it all.
Thank you.
Really?
I'm the person who rejects the main character before she goes and kills her first robot. So I'm responsible for her sentence.
Well done, sir.
Yeah, so everyone out there who likes Westworld, thank you, Chris Malika.
Believe this mythology we're spreading.
Right. This is also my job in life. I'm like the John Stockton to Chris's Karl Malone. I'm there to get him the ball so he can score. Oh, that's kind of how.
That's like so lost on me. I was like, right, where are we in this round?
I could do like a Nebraska football analogy. Would that make you more comfortable?
It really would. If you could say like, okay, I'm the Rex Burkhead to the Taylor Martinez or something.
You nailed it.
Now I'm lost.
I have no idea what's happening.
I'm like the first AC pulling focus for Chris as DP. okay. No one liked that one. No one liked any of those. Absolutely. I'm going to go back to Stockton Malone. Stockton Malone was my
I like Stockton Malone too. That one's good.
Okay, so you just got back from Austin Film Festival with Family Obligations.
Indeed.
You said this was your first feature. I'm very confused.
That I've directed, yes. So we made a feature that played festivals in 2016. It was distributed on streaming in 2017 called The Mix. Chris and I wrote that together. Chris directed that with a guy by the name of Greg Townsend, was his co-director on that. Chris starred in it, and that was our first feature as a company. And then this one, Family Obligations, I wrote and directed. So this is my first one directing.
And this is all under this entity called In the Garage Productions, right?
That is correct, yes.
And what's the origin of that?
We were in my garage when we were, I think, sophomores in college. We got together over coffee in a diner and both said we wanted to make a movie. And so we just sat in my garage that next summer and I think worked on a script that, you know, we hashed it out and we worked on a table that we didn't lock. So my father kept coming in when the table would fall over and tell us, guys, you know that table locks.
It wasn't great for our confidence. No,
we couldn't handle a table. And that was kind of the origin of it. And also that great Weezer song, In the Garage.
It's a good song. I like it. Yeah. And was the whole point was for Chris to come to LA or, you know, Ken, were you supposed to come to LA too? Or was it just to do this continuously, no matter where you were? What was the, like, what was the long-term goal?
Well, it's funny because, you know, In the Garage predates Chris, you know, thinking about LA. We were in college and we just wanted to make movies together. And then when we got out of school, I took a job teaching. Chris was acting in New York. That led him to LA. And, you know, we, you know, were at the time we were just very good friends. And then we ended up marrying a pair of sisters. So we are now actually family. Oh, wow. So we obviously were always, you know, just in contact and, opportunities to work together. Sort of, we sort of created opportunities at different points in time and kind of kept with it. So it's always been something going on despite it probably never being our full-time grind.
Wait, and just really quickly, did you guys also know each other in high school too? Or just from college?
That's how that's how we met. We went to high school together.
Oh my gosh.
All boys, were you making, Catholic high school.
Yeah.
Were you making movies in high school at all? Or was that not till later?
Really was in college. It was after high school. We'd kind of, you know, we were both sort of artsy guys. Chris was in the plays and I worked on the literary magazine and we were friends. And I think it was kind of once we were out of there, you know, Chris went to Ithaca and was studying acting and I went to NYU and was studying screenwriting. And we kind of met back on Long Island in the summers and said, you know, let's do this.
And we shot a film on DV tape and finished it. We had hired a bunch of people who bailed because they said SAG didn't support it. We had no idea what SAG was.
Oh, yeah. Guess that would happen, right?
So the whole thing fell apart. And what we have from that whole summer is now just a trailer for a movie that never happened.
It's a damn good trailer, though.
Yeah, it is.
And so that first movie that you were writing, was that the movie that you shot? And then, you know, it all
no way. No.
Oh, okay.
No
okay.
one should ever see the actual script for that.
Okay. When did The Mix come about? Was that many, many years later?
Yes.
Yeah, that was quite some time later. We were, you know, at that point, we'd gone from being, you know, two kids in college to now I had my second child and, you know, you were in LA for 4 or 5 years by then, or four, I guess
longer
three,
than
4 years,
10 years when we started.
It was that long. Yeah. And, so we had this opportunity. We said, you know, we think we can finally make a feature and we wrote the script and tried to cobble together the resources to do it. And that's how The Mix came about.
Might I say, this is like a fantasy, like what you're describing is like my fantasy. If I were a dude, or just as a woman finding like this collaborator that you marry, sibling, like what is going on here? Are we
I gotta say, you know, I don't want to make the audience jealous or anything, but it kind of is like a dream world every day that I wake up in. It's just it's fantastic at all times.
And the question I was gonna ask was like, while Chris goes off and finds his fame and fortune in Los Angeles as, you know, a writer,
very
director,
generous
actor,
so generous,
all that stuff. What are you doing in the East Coast, Ken? Are you
so? I was a high school. Yeah, okay. I was a high school English teacher. It's actually funny. One of my earlier students in that was just the AD on this project and is the director of our next feature film.
Oh man!
And we've worked with several, and another one of my students who is in Family Obligations is going to be in this next film as well. So I've kind of brought the teaching life into the filmmaking life and overlapped and crisscrossed with all these different people. So yeah, so I was back here and my wife, Shauna, who's the EP on our projects, we got married. She was doing her PhD. I was teaching full time. We had two little girls. We got to a point where the mix was done and she had a full-time tenure track position as a professor. And we made this decision that I would stay home and concentrate on the girls and on writing to a little more of a degree. And actually the day I went into my boss and said, this is going to be my last year, was the day we got our first festival acceptance for the mix. Ironically,
oh, wow. That's lovely.
Not by design, but it was just a nice moment there.
The fairy tale continues.
It's been a very blessed life. I mean, when we get into like what our budgets have been on these projects, the fairy tale goes away, but
no, it's still a fairy tale. Like that's like you were able to make and do what you love. Even I think micro budgets are a blessing, not a curse.
I love it. I love working this way. Yeah. I think there's a lot to it that people would embrace. I think that it scares people off. But there's a tremendous amount of autonomy and a lot of cool stuff you can do. And I'm a big evangelist for that style.
Me too. So in terms of just like, I want to get back to the origin too, though. So it's like your best friends, your family, you're making these movies. Are you making these movies together because there's something you collectively want to say with every film? Or is it like, we just want to hang out for 16 to 20 days? Or like, what is the goal for each of these movies?
I think so prior to the feature, we had done a number of shorts and those were mostly spearheaded out here. Kenan wrote the first short that we did and that got into, I think, one festival. And we were just doing kind of shorts that way. And when the idea for just doing a feature just seemed, we were putting all this money and effort into shorts and it was just having no outcome. So when the idea to do a feature came through, it was just, let's write something that we could do. Here's the people that we have. What's a plot line that makes sense? And Ken sat down, came up with this plot that we could shoot in the apartment building I lived in. And that involved actors that I knew out here who I'd worked with, who we enjoyed, and just kind of what's a movie that we'd want to see. And it kind of was just this broad, dark comedy that has a message that I like to think that, you know, we like to think kind of goes a little bit deeper than just that.
And I think that's a critical element too, is I think Chris and I have a similar taste and style of storytelling. And I think a love of the characters we've created. So I think we work on projects that just kind of jive with us and we respond to, and I don't necessarily know if we'd get to other ways. So I think that's what this kind of feeds.
Yeah, they're smaller stories in the end. They're not, we're not space opera people.
Yeah.
We're like two people meet.
Right. Let's talk about family obligations really quickly. So, you know, you had your first film, it was a success, you know, got into film festivals, got, distribution, now you're making your second film. Like, talk to us about how that came about. Like, how did you guys come up with the idea? And then how did you get the funds for it?
So I had this, you know, kernel of a story idea that I started fleshing out. And as I was writing it, I really got attached to telling this particular story. And I thought, you know, of the things I've kind of written and maybe ignored or thought, I'm not going to be able to do that. This seemed to me something that we could really handle. This is not just handle, but I think do well. And it really was a sort of a moment of form meeting function. It was like, this is a micro budget movie. This is something that we could achieve. So I wrote it and I handed it to Chris. And, you know, like he had said, we had shot The Mix, our first feature out in Los Angeles. And I really wanted to do something back in New York. I wanted to kind of build it out from our home base. So we started assembling it on Long Island. And I knew I could bring Chris in, bring Chris back home, so to speak, to anchor it. So I was able to write knowing that I was going to give, you know, the bulk of the screen time and really the hard stuff to put on an actor I knew could do it and really hang the script on Chris's performance. And then, you know, we just started filling out the world of the movie as we needed it from there.
And then did you know what budget you had to work with when you got started? Or was it kind of like, let's make this for as little as we possibly can in order to get the film on camera?
It was a question of what does this make sense at, right? I mean, you know, Obviously we wanted the number to come in as low as we could. Because we were self-funding. So to cut to the chase of, we didn't have anyone to go to ask for money with the first film.
Did you try? Like, did you attempt to gather funds in that way?
In an honest sense, a little. I would not say it was exhaustive, but I would say that we kind of went out there. Now, obviously, since we made our first feature, that was a moment for us, I think, to, you know, quite honestly be like, all right, well, we've made a first feature and it got distributed and it won some awards at festivals. And what is the interest in from someone else in seeing another movie? And it turned out the world was pretty callously indifferent to the idea of the two of us making another movie.
It was the sound of shrugging across the nation.
But that's how it is for everyone.
It was like, come on, you guys like us. We're a fun story, right? Look, come on, dance for them, Chris, dance. You know, and
that's funny.
It was, you know, so when the crickets kind of subsided, but you know, my wife Shauna, who like I said was the EP on has been the EP on pretty much all our projects. We sat down and she's very good at, you know, the realistic look at it and the budget. And we said, all right, this would be great at 12, would be fine at 16. I could tolerate it at 20. If it goes above 20, it doesn't make sense anymore. And we brought in at 16. Wow. So we made it for $16,000. With the budgeting of that meant we had 8 days of a SAG ultra low budget contract.
Wow.
We went around, got our locations. We were lucky. I mean, you know, I'm on Long Island. And what's nice about Long Island as opposed to, say, Los Angeles is that people are, I think, a little less, maybe I don't want to say jaded about shooting.
They're not going to charge you $1,000 an hour.
Exactly.
For a location.
I walked into the Chinese restaurant that we get takeout from, and it was like they didn't know they could say no to me. They let us shoot there for free. They were super, super kind and welcoming. And I walked out of there and I called up Chris and his wife Brett, my sister, and I was like, you're not going to believe this, they let us shoot for free. And Brett's first reaction was, no one would ever let you shoot for free in Los Angeles.
Didn't you order from them that night too?
I order from them constantly, and we just go in there, and so we kind of actually had the crowd on our side, so to speak, here, because, you know, there's not a lot of people making movies. We went to the laundromat around the corner from our apartment, and after we shot in there, they like, took pictures with Chris because they thought it was so cool that we were shooting a scene in there. So
that's cool.
It was great. And it was great because, I mean, we grew up here and I live here and my kids go to school here. And it was just like the type of thing of, it felt from my perspective, just on a personal level, it felt really great to kind of be embraced and think like, oh, good for you. You're doing it. Which was just a really welcome and wholesome feeling when we're doing that. So that was great. We were able to do it more cheaply here than we would have been other places. And we got some nice bounces in our favor.
And I also assume that, like, your team, like, maybe can you edit or you shoot or, like, there's doubling up of those positions as well at that budget level?
There's a ton of that, yeah. So basically our core is, you know, the four of us, Chris and Brett in Los Angeles, my wife Shauna and I in New York. Like I told you before, my assistant director on this project is a guy by the name of Kevin Wolfring. He was a student of mine. And so he was my AD, but, I mean, we were appropriately – the whole crew. I mean, I DP'd, I operated. He would be sort of the gaffer and grip. He was G&E basically. Sometimes we had someone else running sound. Sometimes Kevin was running sound while I was running camera. We had an assistant. We had, like, you know, we basically kind of just a catch-all camera assistant, PA, you know, everything. A college student by the name of Katie Tracy who filled in the gaps. Set Katie, and she was fantastic. And when my wife could be on set, she was on set helping out. But that was the crew. There was no other crew. And then editing was Kevin and Chris editing. And the one real luxury, and like you had this as a question, is what do you spend on? What was worth it? I was very fortunate to find a colorist before the project that I went out and shot camera tests and gave it to him. And we developed the look ahead of time. And then he's just an incredibly capable guy, and he really took to the project, and he said, hey, how about I also do your sound design and final mix? And he threw that on for a laughably low price. So where I spent in post was just this one person who is responsible for, you know, the look and the final sound. So, you know, just the picture and sound, really nothing big.
And what did you guys shoot on?
We shot on a Blackmagic pocket cinema, the original 1080 pocket cinema.
Oh, wow.
With anamorphic adapters. So we did a 2.39, you know, we finished in 2K scope.
Wow.
And we went for this kind of very, I think pretty stylized. We pushed a pretty aggressive super 16 millimeter look on it. So it's very grainy. It's very contrasty. The color's very saturated.
Where'd you get your lenses from?
So I shot on a lot of it was on a Panasonic 12-35 zoom.
Okay.
And then I also shot on an Olympus 17 millimeter prime. When I had to go really small and be kind of conspicuous, I used what is really meant to be like an iPhone anamorphic adapter.
Okay.
But they make it with a 37 millimeter thread, so I could attach that onto the lens.
So it was an anamorphic adapter that you're just putting standard lenses on. Okay,
that's right. Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah, I mean, just because we've been, you know, we couldn't afford to shoot on anamorphic lenses for my movie, and you know, we were trying to find an anamorphic adapter, but we couldn't find one that would fit our camera, the lenses that we have, basically. So then we're just like, fuck it, we're gonna shoot in 2.1. You know, which is the same aspect ratio that The Handmaid's Tale shoots in. So I'm like, that's good. I like that. I'm happy.
What I'm really compelled by for looking down the road is that they just pushed this new update to the Blackmagic, the new Blackmagic Pocket cinema cameras, the 4K and the 6K. And it lets you use a 4:3 aspect ratio on the sensor, so you can use the 2X anamorphic lenses.
Oh, yeah.
And wow. SLR Magic has those. They have a 35, a 50, and a 70 prime anamorphics for Micro Four. I mean, I've been pricing that out and like thinking about like, all right, I want to do the next thing I'm writing. I want to shoot it that way. And That's like, if I can get fancy,
right.
That would be where I'd go for that. Cause it is, I love the look of it. I love what it let us do. I think it was something that made us look a little different from typical festival fare.
Right.
I think it gave us something a little extra, but I was really proud of myself because I basically constructed an anamorphic zoom lens, which you just don't get. Unless you can buy these like vintage ingenue, super expensive lenses, and this super, super cheap, super, super small anamorphic prime lens that I could, you know, shoot in and out of the back seats of cars and inconspicuously on the boardwalk in Long Beach. And, you know, I felt like I was really getting away with something with that setup.
Did you feel challenged that you had to run camera and direct at the same time? Or did you feel like, no, I'm comfortable with this sort of setup?
I mean, it was the only way I was going to be able to do it because I couldn't afford to really hire her. What I did that made it nice was that I just really tried to do as much prep as I could. I did as much pre-visualization as I could, shot listing, storyboarding. And really, again, like what I tried to say to each actor I met with was, you know, I'm lighting the scene, not the shot. I'm going to keep the camera running as much as I possibly can. Like, you know, we're shooting in 8 days. It was a 94-page script. Do the math. You know, we needed to move.
I don't feel so bad anymore. Jeez Louise, that's crazy.
So it was really about just like, I want to give you as many takes as you can to get the performance down. I'm not going to spend a lot of time adjusting lights, and this is not an exercise in you know, beauty shots. We're going to keep it as simple as we could. I tried to reduce setups to as many as I could and just tried to, you know, just get as much out of each day as we possibly could. So in some respects, though, you know, obviously it's a challenge to operate and direct.
Right.
It meant that I wasn't having conversations with a team. I was just doing it and we were up and running very quickly. And we probably could break out a few extra takes that if I had, you know, a DP who I'm talking to set up the shot and then he's communicating to, you know, a gaffer and then we're moving the equipment in. I think it ended up being, I think, it's probably obnoxious to say it was a strength. It's not a strength, but it was something we could kind of take advantage of for what it was.
If you had, you know, $10,000 extra dollars, would it go toward hiring a DP who could work for you? Or would it be to pay Chris a little bit better? Would it go to more days on set? Like, where would you put that money looking back?
I would have given it all to Chris.
No.
No. I would have gone for more days. I absolutely would have gone for more days.
Every day he would look me directly in the eye and say, I need more days for you to get this right.
Every day I'd say, you are being overpaid. You are not worth
it,
sir.
You're overpaid and you're not getting your lines at all.
No, I mean, you know, it was really I think the spirit of the thing, though, it was, you know, we did the SAG ultra low budget contract and, you know, Chris is a SAG actor and has worked on you know, far larger TV show and movie sets than anything we were doing. But really, the other actors were largely, you know, new to something like this. And I think really appreciated working with someone like Kristen, also working on a set where they were getting paid on the SAG contract. So
Ken really trusted us to on set kind of knock while they were setting up, because it was just the two of them. We'd knock the scene around, kind of play it once for him to see how he liked it. And that was always helpful.
Yeah. And we did need to move quickly. So it would have been great to have more days. At the same time, it would be interesting to work with a larger crew. I wonder what that would have been like. We had a little larger of a crew on the mix, and I think the same thing, though, you'd want more days.
Oh, easily for that one, yeah. We had a lot of people, a lot of moving parts, and we crammed that into 9 days.
And you've done these two micro-budget features, and I tend to be the one who asks bigger questions. I feel like Arik probably still has, like, 5 more process questions, but let me steal this moment. So if you've done 2 micro-budget features, would you do this exact same situation again for a third feature? I mean, are you going to keep on plugging away?
Next week.
Oh, shit.
Wow. Oh, this is where Liz tells us how ill-advised it all is.
No, I'm so proud of you guys. This is fantastic.
How do we do it, Ken? How do we make our money?
Volume.
Thank you.
No, we are about to move. This is actually going to be, we're going to be shooting in Queens, New York. It's a script that Chris wrote. And as I said before, my assistant director on this film, Family Obligations, Kevin Wolfring, will be the director of this.
Wow.
We had the reading last night.
We had the table read last night. I'm going to DP it. And we have some of the same people returning. We have a bunch of new people. And, you know, this is going to be another week-long shoot.
So for this one, is it the same budget or less or different or more?
It's less, if you could believe it. Wow. Or at least that's so, you know, whatever Ken and Sean have worked out in terms of how to make a movie cheap and fast and good, they've done it so that the budget for this one was a little bit less. So the major contributors to the movies have been just the four of us, the original kind of garage folks.
So going back to the release for your first film, did you guys do self-distribution, or did you actually get a regular distribution deal?
Comedy Dynamics did it.
Yep.
That is correct. Comedy Dynamics, yeah.
It was one of those weird Hollywood things where I went to someone's birthday party, and then someone who later became a part of Comedy Dynamics remembered me from that party, saw a trailer while she was at one of the festivals, and said, oh, that guy was nice at that party. Maybe his movie's good.
I mean, it was a niche comedy SVOD, right? That was the platform. And so it was a digital release, I assume. Mm-hmm. But I assume also, if you're willing to talk about it, that they gave you a little bit of money to get it on the platform. Is that true?
Yeah, which is kind of, you know, one of the things that's interesting to me is that deal was done in 2017. We started the deal in the beginning of 2017, and it landed on platforms in October of 2017, so it took the better part of the year. And from what I understand, and you know, Liz, you probably know far more about this than we do, that was a time when you still did get a little minimum guarantee, or when you still could get a little minimum guarantee, which we were lucky enough to get, which was nice because that made going into another movie seem plausible.
It felt like success.
And it's also back when we had niche SVOD platforms. Like we had, you know, the Korean drama platform, Drama Fever. I mean, Shudder still
exists. I always wanted to break into that one.
But I did a whole report on this at Sundance. There used to be all of these tiny little SVODs, and then they just got wiped out and went bankrupt or got absorbed over and over again.
Chris and I have been trying to puncture the K-pop world for a long time now.
There's still a couple of them left. Just shout outs to BLK Prime and Quali TV, who I've worked, you know, Quali TV was on the show, and then you know, BLK Prime I've worked with before. They're still alive and kicking. I don't know how much money they're making, but you know, Quali TV was successful when they were on the show a year ago, I think it was, maybe. So yeah, I don't know. And I think they're still out there. I see their stuff on Facebook still. So I don't know. I mean, I feel like they must still be happening to some degree. But maybe less, I guess.
I think we were at a lucky moment when that happened, just because this one platform was like, we need to buy plenty of content, and we just happen to find them.
What I think was so interesting about that, though, is that we, you know, went through that deal, and like I said, at that time, you know, there was still a little of a minimum guarantee, and we got a voluminous contract that had, you know, everything in it, and wanted paper on every piece of music, and wanted paper from every performer and every above the line person, et cetera, et cetera. And then with this movie, which obviously is 2019. You know, so we're talking about one going live in October of 2017, one went up in July of 2019, less than 2 years difference, could not be more different. Tiny little contract, no paper needed from almost anybody or anything, flying by the seat of the pants, because this is now just such an open market and there's so many more deals being done that it's not like a theatrical contract that you're signing over.
They're like, tell us you didn't murder anyone on set and you're cool.
Yeah, it was literally like, just send me an email that says you own it. You know, and you're like, oh, okay, I sure, that sounds good. Whereas before, we were having lawyers redline it, and, you know, it is amazing to me how different it is.
So you're saying that the Family Obligations already has distribution through another platform?
Yeah, we're distributed by Proven Entertainment. Okay. We're up on Amazon right now, and we're going to be adding more. We have one more festival screening. We'll be in Tampa Bay in the beginning of December. We're going to play the Tampa Bay Underground Film Festival on December 8th. And then that will be the end of our festivals. And then I think we're going to be expanding to a few other platforms from there. I've heard we're going to be Tubi, Roku, and things like that. I don't have a timeline just yet, but that's where we're going. And again, you know, the speed with which we're hitting platforms is different. The windows, the attitude or the approach to monetization, you know, is so different from
it's shrinking.
That contract.
The windows are shrinking, they're overlapping.
That's exactly right, exactly.
But why did you decide Proven Entertainment?
So I went out really early with this. With the mix, we had finished our festival run, and I think we kind of were like, well, okay, that was fun.
We were proud that we made a movie. We were like, oh, we did this movie, and then we had no idea where to go.
Mission accomplished. We hung the banner and we moved on. No, and then someone reached out to us and was, you know, saying, oh, well, we should try to, you know, get this out there. And I wanted to kind of truncate the process. We had such a long process with the mix, from script to production, post-production. So I said, you know, I don't want to be tied up in this for years. And as we were going out to festivals, I went out to distributors, and I went out to see if there's any interest. Very quickly heard back from people, both positively and negatively, and had a few conversations, pursued a few different places, and landed Proven.
Wow. And then no MG this time, I take it, right?
No, yeah, no MG this time. And that was, you know, again, pretty much everyone was very upfront about that. That was not going to happen.
And then with your other deal, past the MG, did you see returns on the mix through streaming at all? Or was it just kind of the MG and then that was it?
So far, it's the MG and that was it. We have a fairly long term on that contract, so there's obviously hope that
there's the promise.
Right. We could stir up right. We could stir up interest, or, you know, subsequent projects will drive people, but, you know, we have not seen that yet.
Yeah, well, with your budget so low, the MG must have been a pretty substantial percentage, right, of what you guys paid for the movie, I'd imagine.
Yeah, that certainly helps soften it. And I think basically we had the attitude of, if this is all we see, then we'll ride with that and, you know, go from there.
Anything coming back was pretty amazing. Like I said, we made the movie and we kind of hit that brick wall. We thought that was the thing, that we'd got through it. And then sitting there with the movie, you're like, oh, I didn't think of a home for this baby.
So we talked to a lot of filmmakers who have made more than one feature lately, or we have been talking to a lot of filmmakers who have made more than one feature. And I think we're talking a lot about cynicism and like long-term goals and how cynicism can get wrapped up in those. So it sounds like you guys haven't hardened, you know, like you're still doing this for the joy. Do you ever feel frustrated by the lack of response to the film, or is like the film you built up in your mind different than the one that's been received? Is there any tension there?
I know that when I started dreaming of making my own movie, like when we finished the mix, I felt like a dream had come true. I wanted to make a movie. It sat in front of us. It played in the theater. I saw it, and it was a miraculous thing. And then the silence that followed was deafening. So it was a little shocking to kind of live in that space, to be like, oh, people aren't going to come out just because you finished it.
Right.
There has to be the sell. There's so many parts of it. I think for this one, for Family Obligations, what's been great is Ken and Sean really approached this with the end in mind. They kind of saw how the process of the mix went and kind of built that into the making of the film in the first place. So the response has been pretty reasonable. Like, we're getting reviews. People are watching it. Apparently it's on all those sites that you keep finding on, Ken. Keep finding all the...
We are pirated everywhere.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah,
we're all around the world.
That's really cool. I like piracy. I'm sorry. I do.
Me too.
You must be honored by it, right?
Well, absolutely. And I mean, not to get into weird digressions, but one of my very favorite things is Google translating foreign language reviews that pop up and then sending them to Chris.
He made me a video of my face and then the reviews. Wow.
The Chinese piracy site reviews. And they're spectacular. They're great. They're better than anything that could ever be found. And it's gratifying just that people are finding the film and watching the film. I really fight cynicism, and for me, it really, you know, to get back to the core of that question, to me, the fact that we made something that people can find and can watch will never not be a dream come true for me. It will never not be something that I'm impressed by. I'll always have it in me to be excited that we created something. You do realize that, you thought of it as like a flight of stairs with 10 steps, and then you find out that it's 100 steps and it's 1,000 steps, and you know, you're constantly coming up against the next ceiling and the next ceiling. It would be tremendous to break through to a bigger audience and a bigger audience, and that's something we're hopefully going to grow. But I like working this way, as we were saying before, and you could get cynical about it, and you could say there's only so much impact a micro budget feature can have, and that's certainly true. I think obviously you're competing with things so much greater than you. But at the same time, if you're telling a story you believe in and you're able to share it with an audience, even a small audience, I think that's incredible. We're a country of about 350 million people. You know, there's an audience for your film. It might be a small audience, but 350 million people is a lot of people.
Someone's bound to want to hear what we have to say.
Right. Someone's looking for your, you know, whatever, you know,
particular like voice
indie comedy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, there's just fans of everything everywhere, which I think is a really wonderful approach to have, you know, and that it's like really your responsibility as a filmmaker to get the word out and make sure people see your movie. Because, you know, even if you get distribution, like, it's pretty clear that no one's really going to put as much effort into it as you will, you know?
And everyone can get distribution. Just like we keep on saying get distribution, but like distribution's super easy to get. Like, we need to just keep on saying that it's super easy, but it's all about finding good partners, right?
Right. The right partners.
Yeah. And I think that that's exactly the idea, is that, you know, I think for the longest time we felt like that was this insurmountable hill to climb. And then you find that, you know, you can get your film out there. And then it's about getting your film out there better, and about kind of finding finding the audience for it, finding the niche to advertise it.
Getting your messaging right too. I think that's part of it. Getting like knowing how to talk about your movie, even that's something that I don't think we learned in the first movie.
Oh yeah.
And we just come out and like people are like, "What's your movie about?" And we're like, "It's a comedy."
Yeah, you gotta have that hook, right?
Yeah.
Like, to be able to draw them in, you know, something that they makes people want to, you know, find it later or click watch or whatever it is.
You know? Right. I think it's funny when when you go to a festival screening and you get to the Q&A and the, you know, person moderating the Q&A kind of tees up for you, what they think you're going to say about the film. And at least with this film, that's not necessarily, you know, I think everyone thinks this is an autobiographical tale I'm telling, and I'm not. So that's always kind of deflating to the person asking me questions, that I don't have a sob story to kind of relate to them.
They also think I'm a really sad person. So many people come up and go, "Wow, I thought you'd be a miserable person and you're kind of happy.
Chris Malika, my favorite Twitter celebrity, is a sad person."
Yes. My only fan.
No, I really like, I am funny. A big fan of Chris's. I think everything he writes on social media is gold.
Thank you, Liz.
I must follow now.
There you go. Got a new follower.
There it is.
So I have a question, and I don't know if this is getting too in the weeds, but you talked about how you got your distribution settled before or as you were applying to film festivals. Did the distributor care at all about the festivals that you got into? Like, were they kind of tracking with you, like when you got accepted and when you got rejected, and sort of using those opportunities to market the film? Or was it like they're completely not involved at all in the festival run?
They were very hands off about it. I alerted them about Austin because I thought that was, you know, kind of on a bigger scale and a little more.
Oh yeah. Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah. That was a very cool experience. But for the most part, I even said to him, cause I know, you know, again, this is something that's changing, but you know, we were concerned that festivals would be turned off by the fact that we were available and on Amazon and things like that. And it turns out everyone was just, you know, fine with that.
It just meant we couldn't compete. That was the big thing about right. Austin.
Right. We didn't compete in Austin.
Oh, I see.
But I said to the distributor, you know, is that a problem? He said, no, if anything, it's great. You know, you'll be in a local market and you'll pop up and that's, I'm all for it. Go for it. Pursue festivals vigorously. And, you know,
also really, someone at a festival comes up to you and says, I can't make your screening time. And you're like, well, too bad. You can go watch it online.
Absolutely.
You have to watch this movie.
Yeah. Your excuses are gone.
Yeah. When you did get distribution, did you get released before you got into any film festivals, or did you guys plan it out where you played a big festival and then you released on the same day, or were they completely, completely separate?
It was completely separate. What was funny about it was that
plan, though. You should do that next time, Ken.
Well, that was honestly one of the things that was surprising from this time to the last time was with the mix, we got a date, you know, I want to say maybe 4 months in advance is okay. This is going to be a release date. And here's the press release that's going out.
We were putting gifts out.
Yeah, exactly. There was trailers. Here's your social media campaign.
Put these pictures on your social media.
Right. And it was very coordinated. And when I spoke to my distributor for the second film, his attitude very simply said to me, I'm not losing any time to make money on this. I'm getting it up right away. And that made sense to me.
Right.
I said, yeah, okay. That, you know, and I didn't think the film was going to age particularly well. So I liked that idea. You know, no, it's a Halloween story.
Like a fine wine.
Yeah, it's a Halloween story. Let's wait till October, you know.
No movies age well. That's what
right.
I've been learning.
So his thing was get it up out. Right away and do it. And I liked that. And so it was funny because that was, again, an education in how things had changed in such a short period of time. It went from this very coordinated, very controlled, all platforms at once to we're going to put it up on platforms as quickly as you can. And if Amazon accepts it faster, Amazon gets it first.
And then what kind of – do you get to see the reports from them of like what kind of views you're getting, what kind of downloads you're getting? Since you've been out and, you know, on Amazon?
Yeah, we're due for a report at the end of the fourth. Basically, it's a quarter delayed. So we went live in quarter three. And so in Q1 of the next year, we'll get quarter three. It's basically a little lag. So we'll get our first statement of where we've been and how it's gone in January.
Right, right. And so do you expect that, like, you'll get money back from that first quarter payment, or do you think that like they're going to have like promotional costs and expenses and things that are going to keep you from seeing any money until like, you know, the third or fourth quarter that you've been released?
So this was a no costs contract. There was no, I'm not getting any fees.
They're not marketing it. They're not spending marketing dollars on it. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct. Yeah, we do not have so basically it's up. And it's what we can do and what the algorithm can do for us. And we have our split and, you know, so there will be revenue and whatever revenue there is, we are entitled to our split of it. We're not recouping any costs.
You're not going to get shut out, but from any money at any time in this deal. That's great.
Right. Which again is another difference from the first deal where we did incur significant costs with them because they took, and again, differences, they took out E&O insurance on us and they did.
We were in deadline, which was really cool. We have a deadline.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
No, they did some press and they coordinated social media campaigns and they got us into, as you said, deadline, and it was picked up in a couple of other outlets, and you know, so we're still.
My parents were proud of me for a day. It was amazing.
Nice. Only one day.
Just the one. You don't ask for a lot.
They're done.
So, what is your ultimate goal then, as storytellers? Is it to continue to make these lovely films?
For me, I just like telling human stories. I know that sounds kind of sappy and small, but people are what really got me interested in being an actor in the first place. The idea of like inhabiting someone, figuring out what works about them, what doesn't, the way they connect to the world and to each other. And so with these smaller things, it's lovely. Like I said, even with the mix, which is a bit more of a broad kind of dark comedy, we kind of slip the medicine in with the sugar where like it's more of a rumination on what does it mean to live a life well? What does it mean to be good? And so, yeah, I think if possible, keep making these kinds of movies, push them a little bit further. And if you know, by we're going by the volume principle, if we can keep doing it and one of them breaks through, someone, somehow the algorithm, God bless the algorithm, someone finds it. If Chrissy Teigen finds one of our tiny movies and something in it speaks to her about human connection, that'd be beautiful, because that's, as the bombast gets bigger, I would like that the smaller voices are more honest and direct.
No, I completely echo that. For me, this is a form that I like working in, and you know, I think it's amazing to see what people can do on bigger sets and with bigger budgets, and that's fantastic. But I really like to see it as the way in which I can work and the way in which I can tell the stories I want to tell. So I'm very much committed to keep working at this scale. I also love, like, one of the things I love about it is working with, you know, unknown actors. I like working with people who really are excited to have an opportunity to be in a film.
Unknown actors other than Chris, who is very famous and my favorite Twitter celebrity. Well, I mean,
he started, Chris Malenko, starter of Westworld, basically created Westworld.
You're welcome, Westworld.
I don't think he got EP or creator credit on it, but I'm pretty sure he gets the money for it. No, but I love working, you know, kind of in small intimate settings and with, you know, small crews. And I love that, you know, we are in a place and a time where you can do that.
Chandler Rosenthal, someone, the co-star in Family Obligations, she's one of the leads of the next film as well. And she's someone who just kind of has that kind of push as well. She's grounded, she's real, and you just, the opportunity isn't always there for beginning actors. And Ken gave her an opportunity, a huge one.
Nice. I really believe that there's so many people, there's so many talented people who want to tell stories and who want to act and who want to write, and just, I love being a part of that ecosystem where it's possible to do it, and you don't have to, you know, move to LA or New York or whatever. You don't have to, you know, incur huge debts or apprentice yourself for years and years. I love that you can dive in. So I'm very much committed to keeping this going and trying to make movies this way, basically until my wife tells me to stop doing it.
You know, Ulrich and I have been talking about, like, why we podcast and why we do this show. And I feel like just hearing your enthusiasm and your attitude is become a little bit more why I do this show. So I just wanted to say thank you for being such badass filmmakers.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's fantastic to hear. Yeah.
Yeah. You guys are making my problems seem smaller, now. But I still have this big dilemma with my movie, and I was going to actually ask all three of you what you would do in my situation. Ooh. Although I kind of know what you guys would do in my situation, but, I'm going to ask it anyways. So basically I'm waiting to find out if I'm going to have, an investor come in for 20% of my budget. Let's just say maybe it's a little bit less than that. It's more like 15, 10, something like that. And I find out on Monday if they're in or out, right? And I'm set to shoot in 3 weeks from now. And if I don't have that last 10, 15%, whatever it is, I'm going to be in big trouble because I won't have enough money to pay everybody and get the movie made. So what is your advice to me? Like, would you wait and postpone the shoot and piss off all the crew that I have booked and set and ready to go and wait until I can raise that last bit of money that I need? Or would you find some way to cut the budget down, like cut the corners and just shoot the damn thing anyways, in 3 weeks?
I think it's time to use your imagination. I think you're ready to shoot this movie. I think now's the time to shoot this movie. I think Ken agrees with that, and that, you know, this story, if you've built yourself up to do it, you're ready to tell it. You could wait and it will be quote unquote perfect then? Maybe not. Maybe you'll get that money and it'll fall apart. Maybe you won't get what you want when you wait for that money.
No, I couldn't agree more. That's exactly how I feel. And it is funny, going to Austin, we had the experience of talking to several people who, and this is funny, and you got to appreciate the layers of humor to it, where we were there with a feature film. And so for a lot of people, they had some presumption of the type of people we must be and the type of filmmakers we must be and the scale at which we must work to have a feature film at the Austin Film Festival, which is cool. And they would come and say things like, you know, I've got this script I'm raising money for, and I think I need $500,000 to do it. And I've got, you know, $250,000 already. And I'm holding on for the next $250,000. And, you know, then you'd put your cards on the table and say, well, we're here with the feature we made for $16,000. That kind of kills a conversation.
They're like, I can't do that. That's not what I want to do.
Yeah. They want you to bust their table for them when that's done. They're like, you have wasted my time. Bust their table. You have wasted my time, sir. I am dumber for having spent this moment with you.
I want to make a movie. Man. I'm not sure if you heard me. I'm trying to make a movie.
Get out of my sight. No, you plebeian. No, but it's honestly, you know, and I understand that. And like I said, believe me, I mean, God, the things you can do with a budget and the things you can do when you have, you know, the people and the resources, I'm not insensible to that. But, you know, for me, I was talking to a couple of different people in this very, very scenario saying, you know, you could do this for 100, not 250. I'm not saying doing it for 10 out of the sport of it, but you actually have real money in your hands, you know, go do it. And, you know, little by little, you know, people would reveal, well, you know, they want to have the safety net under them, or they
want
to have...
They want the star. They want someone right, who's
They
gonna...
want the star. They want to know they're going to make a sale, or whatever it might be. And, you know...
They want the multiplex always.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I hate to use a word like purity, but when you're working really close to the ground, as we are, you know, your expectations are obviously far lower. And I like to think that focuses back on the product. I like to think that focuses back us on making the movie, because I'm not talking to someone about the foreign pre-sales I'll get if I cast X in the role. And I'm not talking about, you know, some festival handler, like what's going to get me Tribeca.
Chris was good, but how about Chris Evans?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I only used Chris Malika in Family Obligation because Hemsworth was tied up with, you know, Thor and whatever.
Ooh, I'm Hemsworth?
Well, in the Cole, you're not that Chris. I don't know which Chris I want you to be.
Pine is the superior Chris, just so we're on record with that.
Who is Liz?
Pine. Chris Pine. Pine? Is the most superior.
Pine's up there for me, too.
Pine is fantastic, and his Saturday Night Live monologue riffing on this very topic is probably the best piece done on it. But, yeah, I mean, I think that, honestly... When you get down to it, you say, well, what is it about? Is it about making the movie, or is it about, I mean, and also I'm not insensible to the fact it could be an economics decision of, no, this is something that, you know, I've got to make my receipts back and I've got to, you know, this is a business deal. For us, it's an artistic pursuit and it's something that, you know, we're about telling the story. So,
well, I'm also making a sci-fi movie with lots of art department and visual effects and things. So it's not like, you know, there's a lot of hard costs that are hard to get around.
Right, and you can't fudge that. Yeah,
you're held to a different standard.
And then I have certain crew that are asking for a certain, you know, amount of people on their team and everything. And so basically, I could just tell everyone to go screw themselves and, you know, cut their teams by a person, and then you know, like probably be able to make it work that way. But I don't know, that's going to be tough on my crews already doing me a favor by doing this movie.
I think also, you know, so. Never underestimate pickups. We shot three scenes in one day, which is not a feat for the people on this call, but all three scenes ended up in the film and it was our pickups day. So I'm just saying, like, there could be a section of the film that you could say, we're going to shoot this on a second part of principal photography. And in a skeleton, with a skeleton crew, if needed.
Right.
I would agree that both our films were made in the reshoots. I know the mix, without a doubt, the first 10 minutes of the film is all reshoots, and it makes the film land much better. And I think tonally is where we found Family Obligations, in the reshoots.
And the reshoots were so funny with that, because it was actually to fix a continuity error, and I approached it from just a very clinical... Here is the scene with the continuity error. Let's reshoot that scene. And Chris said, I don't want to reshoot that scene.
That scene was so good.
And it was hysterical, because I really looked at him with this look of like, I don't think you understand what this conversation is.
It was a conversation about a coat.
Right. But Chris came back with an idea that really did, you know, we had to fix this continuity error. This wasn't a stylistic, this was an artistic choice. It was just, we had this continuity error we needed to fix. And it really became an opportunity to do something in this one weird little pickup day that we added a shot in a scene that we couldn't have gotten in principle. And it really, you know, you can see it, you can see touches of it through the movie. And it's a magical little thing. But I think
we sharpened character through one day of reshoots,
and it would have been so. It would have been so easy to get so bummed out and just say like, "Oh man, well, it was a noble effort. What are you gonna do?" You know. And instead of saying, "Well, you know, there's no reason why we can't address this. Let's address this." And so I think that's kind of what you're saying is, you know, right now it seems like not having the budget. You know, what seems like the biggest obstacle right now can end up being an opportunity to do something that you wouldn't have done otherwise. And, you know, which sounds very cliche and very easy to say, but in honesty, you know, you in no other medium do you confront your limitations as immediately as you do in film.
Right.
If you start writing a novel and you set your first scene in space, that's fine. If I write down on the page exterior Yankee Stadium day, 50,000 extras screaming, you know, my wife's going to run in from the next room and say, how the hell do you think you're going to shoot that?
Right, right.
You know, and you confront those limitations so quickly.
Right.
But that there's something wonderful about that as well, because it challenges you to find the way.
So to wrap this up, Ken and Chris both say, just shoot it, figure it out, cut the budget, whatever I have to do to make it happen. Liz, you say the same, but then...
But in a more practical way, like section out... like a scene or two that you're willing to sacrifice to shoot at a later date.
Right.
So that you can have a satellite shoot that fully finishes out your story.
Yeah, yeah.
And to build on that, I mean, really, it's very easy to be high-minded and say that this is the story is, but, you know, in reality, ultimately you want a movie.
Right.
You want to have something you shot and executed. And you can, you know, I could go back and I can nitpick every scene of, and Chris could do this too, every scene of the movies we've done and say, oh, I wish we could have done that. It would have been great if we could have done that. But the fact of the matter is we have two feature films out there now. And that is ultimately far more gratifying artistically than having a scene under ideal conditions have the finished product.
Awesome. Well, Liz, unless you have a final question, I think we're good, right?
No, but if you hear that knocking in the background, that's my baby trying to get in the door.
That's amazing. Plus, you're doing a horror movie right now.
Yeah.
Mine are shuffling off to bed on East Coast time as we speak, so that's kind of fun.
Well done.
Nice. All right. Well, thanks again, guys, for a fantastic conversation. Congratulations with your film. Oh, and before we let you go, where can people watch Family Obligations and The Mix? Like, pimp yourselves out right now.
Wonderful. Well, Family Obligations and The Mix are both on Amazon Prime. The Mix you can find on more platforms right now as it's been out a little longer. Please check those out and please leave us reviews and comments and tell us what you like, tell us what you don't like.
Say how you like that lead actor so well.
The poster guy, the guy who's right, the face of the franchise, as you were.
Awesome. All right, guys. Well, thanks again and have a wonderful evening.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. Thanks to Ken and Chris for being on the show. Their films, The Mix and Family Obligations, are available digitally. And I know they're making a third feature right now, which is a super badass of them.
Yeah.
Wow. Wow.
Wow.
And if you want to check out our website, it's makingmoviesishard.com, where you can find links to the things we talked about on this episode. You could get in contact with us. You could send an email to podcast@makingmoviesishard.com. I actually am reading these emails now, and I know Ulrich's been reading them this whole time. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook at MMIH Podcast. I'm at Liz Manischel on Twitter and Instagram, and Ulrich.
I am at Ulrich B on Twitter and Instagram.
And if you like the show, tell a friend, you know, leave a review, send us an email. I already said that. Rate us on iTunes, all these amazing things that you could do to support us. You know, toss us some Chipotle money on Patreon. Anything is appreciated. But thanks to everyone for being so fabulous, and talk to you all next week.
Later.